This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. A little bit later in the hour, a commercial rocket launch, the first of its kind, into orbit, and also why people believe weird things. We have a different reason than you think. But first, what makes up a galaxy? Well, you got lots of stars, probably some planets, a bunch of dark matter and energy floating in space between the stars. You got a helping of gas, and turns out that there's also now a magnetic field that helps make up a swirling galaxy, and that field might help determine how that galaxy formed or whether there even is a galaxy with more or fewer stars than usual. Writing this week in the journal Nature, a team of scientists report that they have been able to measure the strength of that magnetic field in a far distant galaxy, looking billions of years back in time to when the galaxy was only around 4 billion years old. And when they measured the field, they were in for a surprise. It turned out to be about 10 times what they were expecting. Joining me now to talk about that finding and why it's significant is one of the astronomers on that project. Arthur Wolf is professor in the Department of Physics and the Center for Astrophysics and Space Sciences at the University of California, San Diego. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about the looking at magnetic fields in distant galaxies. It seems a kind of like an esoteric thing for astronomers to do.
Well, not exactly, Ira. Astronomers have been doing this for years in our own galaxy, in the Milky Way that we live in. We've known about magnetic fields for a long time. We know they exist in stars and planets, and also in the gas in between planets. And using various techniques, we've found that the magnetic field in this interstellar gas in the Milky Way is dynamically significant. It affects the motions of interstellar clouds and also affects the rate at which stars form, because the pressure exerted by the magnetic field can prevent the collapse of a gas cloud when it wants to go on its way to make a star.
And by looking at these very, I guess, old or young, depending on how you look at them, something that's happened when the galaxy was about 4 billion years old helps you do what?
Well, it helps us to understand how these magnetic fields originate. That's been a question for a very long time. The leading theory is the so-called mean field dynamo theory, in which the rotation of the galaxy winds up magnetic fields and amplifies them as a function of time. And the time that it takes for the magnetic field to increase by a factor of a few is about one rotation period of a galaxy, which is about 200 million years. So it takes a long time. But the bottom line is, as we look back in time, we expect magnetic fields to be weaker in the past. That's the major prediction of the dynamo theory.
Mm-hmm. So when you find this young galaxy to be 10 times as much magnetic field power as you thought it would be, that sort of upset the apple cart a bit.
Yeah, we were surprised. To be honest, we never expected to detect something like this. And we looked at it for a long time, and there it was. It's a big surprise, and we're trying to understand why it is that this magnetic field is so strong.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any hypotheses about this?
Yeah, we have two right now. One is that we're looking not at a typical location in this distant galaxy, but toward its center. We know in some nearby galaxies that they have strong magnetic fields at their centers. Mm-hmm. And so that's one possibility, that we're looking through the central region of this galaxy. This is important also because in the centers of galaxies, the densities of stars is very large, and that's very important for us because the magnetic pressure of this field that we looked at is so great that it is greater than the weight of the gas above it. However, if you add stars into that mix, the gravity of the stars increases the weight of the gas such that it can balance the field and exist in an equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one possibility, that we're looking through the center of a galaxy. Another possibility that was suggested by my colleague, Frank Hsu, who's a expert on this, is that we're not looking at one galaxy, we're looking at two galaxies in collision. And the benefit of that idea is that these galaxies start out with a mild field, the type of field we see today. I can use these units, 5 microgauss. And what happens is that when the galaxies collide, a shockwave gets sent out, and the shockwave, it increases the density of the gas, but it also amplifies the strength of the field to its current strength, which we think is about 100 microgauss. So that's one benefit of that model.
Any to we lay people, any possibility that the mysterious dark energy or dark matter may play some role in upsetting this idea?
I don't think so. What we're looking at is not dark matter. We're looking at, we see this magnetic field in ordinary gas, in ordinary matter. And so the influence of dark energy and dark matter, I mean, dark matter would play a role in terms of the total gravitational field of the galaxy and how the galaxy rotates. Dark energy, I don't think, would play much of a role in this. We're looking at neutral hydrogen. Should I tell you how we found this field?
Sure.
Okay, we use this technique, which my other colleague, Carl Hylus at Berkeley, has basically been a leading expert in a number of years. It's called Zeeman splitting. So let me tell you how this works. What we do is we see the gas in this very distant galaxy against the very bright light or bright electromagnetic radio waves emitted by a more distant background quasar. And what happens is, as that radiation from that distant quasar comes through the gas leaves an imprint on that light. And the imprint it leaves is what's called a 21-centimeter absorption line. Let me explain what I mean by that. Quantum mechanics tells us that atoms, in this case hydrogen atoms, exist in discrete energy levels. And in this case, if we go from an upper energy level to a lower energy level, a quantum of radiation is emitted, a photon. It's called a photon. Or conversely, if I add a photon to the system, I can go from a lower energy level to a higher energy level. So that's what we've seen. As the light from this distant quasar comes by through this gas, some of this light is absorbed going from one energy level to another. And the imprint that's left is a 21-centimeter absorption line. This was known a long time ago, this object. That's the wavelength of the photon that's absorbed. Now, when I turn on a magnetic field, the magnetic field changes the energy of this atom because atoms are like little dipole magnets. And what was once the upper energy level, which at one time was one level, now splits into two levels. And what we've done is measure this splitting. In other words, instead of the 21-centimeter line being one line, it splits up into two lines, one with a wavelength slightly less than 21 centimeters, one with a wavelength slightly greater. And using the 100-meter telescope at Green Bank Radio Telescope, this is the largest steerable telescope in the world. It's really a magnificent machine. After spending many, many hours looking at this object, we were able to see the splitting. And the magnitude of the splitting tells us how strong the magnetic field is. I hope I've made sense.
Well, I get, but the take-home message is that you found a magnetic field that was 10 times stronger than you thought it would be.
That's right.
And you don't know why that is. You have a couple
of... Not really. I mean, as I said, we have some ideas. We're going to test these ideas with some observations. We're going back to Green Bank again. We're going to look at a much more distant galaxy than this one. We're going back. We're looking at a galaxy whose age is maybe 1 billion years when we see it. And if we see such a strong field in that object, then I would say the dynamo theory is in trouble.
In trouble.
Yeah.
So you
right now, I think, it's a challenge, but it's still...
But you first want to check the data. Make sure you made the right... So you look at other galaxies to see that it wasn't a mistake that you had made.
Exactly. And we did that in our first observation. But you can't be too cautious in this field. And so we're going to do it again. We're going to try to do it at other radio telescopes.
Well, because if you have a revolutionary idea like this, I mean, or a discovery like this, then you better go check it a few times.
You're absolutely correct, Ira. And that's the first thing that occurred to us. We better check it and double check it.
How does this fit into the whole theory about how galaxies and stars form?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say magnetic fields are normally ignored in theories of galaxy formation. One of the reasons is they're difficult to compute. It's it brings in the field of magnetohydrodynamics, which is another order of more
right.
complicated.
It makes your head hurt to think about that word.
What's that?
Makes your head swim to think
of.
I mean, when we go to Astronomy 101, they don't talk about that.
No, they
talk about the little
about
disk
it.
And everything else and all that kind of stuff.
I think they're going to have to, because I think one of the other implications of our discovery, independent of everything else, is that the gas that we look at is more highly magnetized than people had imagined. And what this ultimately does will suppress star formation. And this, a lot of the objects that we look at, high redshift, a lot of these, when you look at galaxies in the distant past, most of the ordinary matter was in gas, not in stars.
Right.
You go far enough back in time. And what, if the object we look at is typical, okay, what this tells us is that the gas was highly magnetized, and this acts to suppress star formation because of this added pressure that I was talking about that mm-hmm. resists mm-hmm. The gravitational collapse of clouds as they, that's how we think stars form, that interstellar clouds just collapse.
And you'd have to explain why the magnetism lessened so you could create the stars?
I'm sorry?
You'd have to explain why the magnetism suddenly was much less so the stars could be created?
Well, that's right. Somehow the fields will have to leak out of the gas, or the gas would have to be much more compressed than the ones we're looking at. But, I mean, if what we're looking at is typical, stars formation will be suppressed in that gas. There may be other regions in this galaxy where this is not the case and where stars form.
Well, good luck to you, Dr. Wolf.
Okay, thank you very much.
We'll check in when you get those other readings.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Arthur Wolf is professor in the Department of Physics in the Center for Astrophysics and Space Sciences at the University of California, San Diego. A bit baffled about take-home message, why the magnetism, electromagnetism, is 10 times what they thought it would be in a very, very young star. And they're going to go out and check their equipment and see what other galaxies look like. These young galaxies, not stars. We're going to take a short break, come back and change gears, and talk about a very good rocket launch. Why 4 is a charm instead of 3. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Next up, a rocket last Sunday lifted off a Pacific atoll of the Marshall Islands and was bound for Earth orbit. But there was something very different and significant about this rocket. It was designed and built privately without government assistance. And the rocket was named the Falcon 1, built and launched by the Space Exploration Technologies Corporation, or SpaceX. It's a private company aiming to provide low-cost launch services and making a business of selling a ride into space cheaper and more reliably than previous launch techniques. Last weekend's rocket launch was the first privately designed and built system to make it, as I say, into Earth orbit. And it came after 3 failed attempts. Joining me now to talk about the launch and what comes next is Elon Musk. He is the founder of SpaceX and the company's CEO and CTO and has a big smile on his face, I'm sure, today. Welcome back to the program, Elon.
Thank you.
So this was the fourth charm, try a charm, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I was just saying that obviously as a joke because the common idiomatic expression is third time's a charm. But this was a great success for us, and we're finally able to iron out all of the design related issues with the vehicle. In our case, it was particularly tricky because the entire vehicle was designed from the ground up. So the first stage engine, second stage engine, all the structure, avionics, guidance, control, was all done internally at SpaceX from a clean sheet. Typically, launch vehicles have a long heritage and contain, or at least many of the components have flown before, but that was not the case in our vehicle. So it took a little longer to iron out the design issues because there were so many new things.
Well, why not just license the design from someone else and build one of those rockets? Why start from the ground?
Because the designs are not good. They're very expensive, and they do not have any potential for reusability. In the case of Falcon 1, it is designed to make a substantial cost breakthrough. A lot of cost is actually there right at the design point. if you design something that is inherently expensive, it's going to be expensive. Mm. And that's typically how launch vehicles have been done in the past. We had to really start from a clean sheet to make something that was low cost to manufacture, and then also which was designed, at least in the case of the first stage, to be to have the potential for reusability. There's only one partially reusable launch vehicle in the world, and that's the shuttle. The main tank is thrown away every time, but the reusable elements of the shuttle are so expensive that it's actually more expensive. It's more costly than an expendable vehicle. One of the big breakthroughs we're hoping to achieve over time is a cost-effective reusability. And so it really required that we start mm-hmm. from a clean sheet.
1-800-989-8255, talking with Elon Musk. Are you saying that there are parts of your of the spacecraft Falcon 1 that can be reused?
The first stage is designed with the potential for reusability. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it did not survive reentry on this flight. But we've got some good data to make improvements, and I think we've got a good shot of recovering it on flight 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm. And how about? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just saying it's a pretty tough job recovering rocket stages, which is why no one has ever succeeded in creating a fully reusable orbital launch vehicle, and why in fact there's only one vehicle that's even partially reusable, which is the shuttle. Mm-hmm. All the other launch vehicles in the world are expendable.
You have to know where you have to send a ship to know where it's going to splash down, I imagine, pretty accurately.
To within about a 20-mile mm-hmm. Distance, yeah.
Yeah, and then you got to fish it out of the water and make mm-hmm. sure it doesn't sink. And
The sinking's not an issue, but when the propellant when the tanks are empty, it has about the density of an empty beer can. So it's not going to sink, and it doesn't really leak or anything mm-hmm. like that. So no danger of sinking, but there is obviously the challenge of ensuring that it does not corrode when in seawater, and that the electronics aren't damaged by seawater. Mm.
What do you foresee now as the first commercial use of your spacecraft?
Well, we have quite a few launch contracts for both government and commercial satellites for Falcon 1, our next flight will carry a satellite for Malaysia, as well as some U.S. government secondary satellites, and that's slated to launch in approximately March. Mm-hmm. And that satellite will be used for monitoring for natural disaster monitoring. So if there's a flood or tsunami or fires or whatever, the Malaysia can direct aid to where it's needed. So that's the next satellite, and then we have probably two more launches, one around the middle of next year, one towards the end of next year. Probably both of those will be U.S. government launches. And then maybe even an additional launch, which would be a commercial launch, for replenishment of the Orbcomm constellation.
And there's going to be a time where the in between space shuttles, where we're not going to have a space shuttle to use to service the space station, right? Can you fill that gap with your space vehicles?
Yeah, absolutely. So the shuttle is slated to retire in 2010. About 2 years ago, NASA held a competition for commercial servicing of the space station after the shuttle retires. SpaceX won that contract, three or four parts of the contract, which are to take pressurized and unpressurized cargo to the space station and return it to Earth. There's mm-hmm. a fourth element to that contract, which NASA has not yet exercised, but we hope that they will. And we do think it's in the best interest of the country, and I think they will, which is to upgrade our Dragon spacecraft to carry people. So in which case the United States would not need to rely on the Soyuz for carrying people to the space station between 2010 and 2015 or whenever the next NASA developed system is available. Hmm. So we're expecting to do our first demonstration flight of our Falcon 9 booster, which is our big booster, and our Dragon spacecraft, which is what will go and dock with the space station next year, and then there are a couple more demonstrations in 2010, at which point we'll go operational.
1-800-989-8255. Talking with Elon Musk of the SpaceX Corporation. So you're saying that it's possible that you could create a little module where people could be sitting in and go back and forth to the space station? Or would they just stay with it while it's up there and keep docked with it at the space station?
They would – actually, we'll be releasing a video probably in a week or two that will give people a very clear illustration of what it is we're talking about. And there's already some information on our website at spacex.com. So if people are curious to see what it is we're referring to, that you can see actual pictures of hardware on the SpaceX website. But essentially, it's sort of a capsule-like architecture, and yeah, it takes up to 7 astronauts to the space station. It can remain attached to the space station for 6 months or more if need be, or it can immediately return to Earth with the 7 astronauts.
Wow! And are you part of the Lunar X Prize competition? That the X Prize will be to put a payload, a working payload, on the moon.
Well, I'm actually a trustee of the X Prize, mm-hmm. And helped fund the original suborbital X Prize that Bert Rutan won, and actually have partly helped fund this prize. In that SpaceX has offered to do any launches for that X Prize at zero profit. So we'll do it just at our cost, and that's just to help teams be able to do that mission. So we ourselves are not going to attempt to do the mission.
Mm-hmm. So that they can use one of your rockets to get to the moon.
Yes.
Yeah, but they come up with the payload themselves. What kind of time frame do you think all of this is going to happen? And are you going to be getting in? If you can carry people to the space station, why not carry people into Earth orbit and make a business out of that as space tourists?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we certainly will do trips to the space station with NASA astronauts and private astronauts, and we will carry private astronauts to Earth orbit if they wish. And then there's also potential for doing some interesting missions like a loop around the moon. We wouldn't have the capability to actually land on the moon, but potentially could sort of loop around the moon, and people could see the backside of the moon and maybe go even a little further than was the case with Apollo.
1-800-989-8255. Crystal in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Crystal.
Hi there.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering how much commercial private space travel would increase what we already have and what kind of effect it would have on global warming, what kind of carbon footprint, how much gas would it take to make one flight of, say, uh-huh. of space tourists?
There's quite a bit of energy needed to get to orbit. However, the number of flights that take place is so tiny that it doesn't even factor in terms of carbon emissions. Also, I should point out we buy carbon offsets for all of our launches, actually well in excess of the carbon that we create, because I'm very much an environmentalist. Mm-hmm. So, even if we didn't buy carbon offsets, it's really such a tiny, tiny portion of the carbon that's created. It doesn't even register.
Thank you, Crystal. Could you make your rocket fuel out of algae like Richard Branson wants to make his jet fuel out of?
Yeah, it's certainly conceivable. You could make the fuel we use is rocket propellant grade kerosene, which is basically a high purity jet fuel. Mm-hmm. So it's our vehicle taking off is like a medium-sized jet taking off. I mean, that's about as much fuel as we use, mm-hmm. equivalent to one medium-sized jet flight.
Mm-hmm. Bauer in Second Life asks, why did the first attempts fail, and how much did the failures cost altogether, and to whom? And why did these ones work? I'll add that.
Sure. We had basically 3 design-related issues with the first three flights. And by the way, flights 2 and 3 made it to space. So I should distinguish between orbit and space, because mm-hmm. flights 2 and 3 certainly made it well beyond the boundary of space, but they just did not reach full orbital velocity. Mm-hmm. And it's much, much harder to reach full orbital velocity than it is simply to get to space. To get to the boundary of space, you only need about, say, 2% of the energy you need to get to orbit.
Wow.
So if you compare the energy capability of our vehicles with, say, Spaceship One, which is what was used to win the Suborbital X Prize, or Spaceship Two, which is what Virgin Galactic will be doing, then you know we're about 50 times the energy of those vehicles. Hmm. But for Flight One, the issue is was basically a corroded nut, and that was because we'd inadvertently used a stress corrosion prone alloy of aluminum, and it was happened to be in a high corrosion environment. So our test stand was in sort of a normal environment, but out there on the island, it's a high corrosion environment. So that made our we encountered an issue that we just didn't see on the test stand, which was very rapid corrosion of a nut. Mm-hmm. So we took corrective action after that. Then flight two, the problem was that. Was with control of the second stage, which is a tricky thing to figure out, because it's going at it goes from Mach 10 to Mach 25 in a vacuum, and accelerating from just under 1G to over 5Gs. So there's no way to really test that well you can't really test that on the ground. You can only model it. And unfortunately, we had modeled it incorrectly.
All right, hang on. Elon, let me jump in and remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
No problem. So the corrective action there was to install slosh baffles, which basically prevent the liquid oxygen in that liquid oxygen tank from sloshing around, and also to change some of the gains and the algorithms in the control system. Mm-hmm. The problem is a bit like if you're trying to run carrying a bowl of soup.
It sloshes around a lot. All right, let's go to number three. What happened with number three?
So number three, number three would have worked if we had kept the same first stage engine as flight two, but we upgraded the engine, because we wanted to use the engine on Flight 3 that we planned to use in our big vehicle, Falcon 9, and get flight history on that before mm-hmm. before using it on our big vehicle. And unfortunately, the thrust transient, which is the during shutdown, which is basically the rate at which the thrust, how the thrust decays over time, was much longer thrust decay than the old engine. And so after we separated the stages, the first stage actually still had residual thrust and basically kept on going forward and rear-ended the second stage.
I hate it when that happens.
Right.
Yeah. See,
tailgating.
Yeah. So you fixed that for number four.
And we basically made a very small timing change to basically extend the time from when we initiate main engine cutoff to second stage to stage separation. We just increased that by a few seconds and solved the problem, and we got to orbit.
Yeah. So for all those people who thought they couldn't understand rocket science, there it is in just about a minute and a half. I got about 30 seconds left, Elon. Where do you go next?
Well, we have a bunch of exciting things happening with Falcon 9. We're going to have Falcon 9 at Cape Canaveral in December. And we hope to do our first launch around the middle of this year, and then followed shortly by our first launch for NASA, which will be a test flight of our Dragon spacecraft. So that's going to be very exciting. I think the SpaceX is really going to make a big difference to the space program and make sure we're not reliant on the Russians after 2010.
Hmm. Well, we'll see you at the Cape.
All right.
Elon Musk, who is the founder of SpaceX and the company's CEO and CTO, thanks for taking time to be with us today. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, come back, change gears one more time, and talk about well, things that appear to be what they are, but they're not really. So you don't even appear to know what I'm talking about. Well, you'll find out more after this break, so stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Unless you've been hiding in a cave these past few weeks, you probably have been aware of a bit of uncertainty in the economy, right? Those markets swinging back and forth, the mortgage problems, the banks going bust. And maybe you're feeling like you're not exactly in control of what's going to happen in Washington or Wall Street or on Main Street. And it just might be that those feelings of being out of control may make you more likely to believe weird things, to subscribe to superstitions, conspiracy theories, see patterns where there are none. New work published this week in the journal Science says that in times when you're not in control, your brain may be more likely to create a sense of control and allow you to believe in things that just are not so. Joining me now to talk about the study is one of its authors, Jennifer Whitson, assistant professor in the Department of Management at the McCombs School of Business, part of the University of Texas at Austin. She joins us from her office in Austin. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ira. It's great to be here.
You're welcome. Is this tendency to perhaps connect the dots where no dots exist, is this a defensive or a survival mechanism or what?
I think it's definitely a survival mechanism. I mean, people are usually very good at perceiving patterns. It helps us to understand what's going on in the world around us so we know how to act and what to do to achieve our goals.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that this is an example of that survival instinct gone wrong.
Good. Give us an example. Let's talk in concrete terms about how you know about this. Let's talk about some of the experiments that you did.
Okay. Well, you know, we looked at a variety of different forms of pattern perceptions. And when I say we, I mean myself and my co-author, Adam Galinsky, at the Kellogg School of Management. And what we did is we showed that across a wide array of situations, things like superstitious perception, thinking that stomping your feet, for example, affected how well your ideas were accepted at a meeting, as well as conspiratorial perceptions, thinking that people were talking behind your back, seeing images in static, detecting trends in the stock market. All of these things are affected by the same visceral need for control.
Hmm. And so when you're out of control, then you try to create these things.
Yes.
To make yourself feel like you're more in control.
Yes. I mean, lacking control is a highly aversive state. And so one of the fundamental ways we can feel in control is to understand what's happening. But if the world is so complex or so chaotic that it's not immediately apparent what's going on, then we reach for illusions.
Hmm. So can you jump and leap to people who are very much conspiracy people, or you know that, those kinds of people? Are they more out of control with things, or feel like they're out of control with things in their lives?
I mean, I think a lot of times when you look at groups of people who believe in these vast worldwide conspiracies with all of these elaborate and arcane plots and secrets, then you know the very groups who believe these things are the groups who do not have a lot of control over, you know, the political system that they're in, or don't have a lot of control over their outcomes or the way they're viewed in general.
Mm-hmm. And would this have anything to do with stress at all causing these things?
I think so. I mean, a lot of lacking control is a very stressful and aversive state. And so I think stress does correlate.
Mm-hmm. Let's tell us about some of the exact experiments. They're kind of fascinating, what you did to put these people feeling like they weren't in control.
Well, in one particular study, we had people recall a time in their life in which they lacked control.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then asked them, presented them with several situations in which you could make a superstitious connection. So I've mentioned already, you know, they were told in one case they regularly stomp their feet before they go into meetings because they feel it's more likely that people will accept their ideas.
Right.
And then before entering one meeting, they're running behind, they forget to stomp their feet, and their meetings are not accepted, I mean, their ideas are not accepted. And then we asked them, how related do you think these two things are? And how worried are you about stomping your feet in the future?
Hmm.
And the folks who had recalled a time in their life in which they lacked control were significantly, saw these two things as significantly more connected. than those who had recalled a time in their life in which they were in control.
Interesting. Let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Matt in Tucson. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you. I was in Somalia back in 1992 and into 93, and it was a very crazy place. And I knew a lot of other journalists, and I knew a lot of aid workers, and just people who had been sucked into the situation. And it was remarkable, the development of superstition that people had and lucky charms from people who would normally have never had it. And more importantly, it was such a convoluted and involved clan structure that people would start to think that they could figure out what everything meant in a gesture from anyone else. And I've read since then, and it's quite common in combat situations, not particularly within the military, but civilians or other individuals, and those really high stress where you have no control, that the way you handle it is you kind of make yourself think like you're really on top of sensing everything that's going on. And when something bad happens, you're like, yeah, I knew that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Whitson?
I think that is exactly the kind of thing we're talking about. When you're experiencing such a severe lack of control, you know, then you're going to reach for those connections between things so that you can feel like you are affecting the world.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling, Matt.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, though, out of that. Afterwards, you could really make some stupid mistakes once you were back in a society where you had control.
Huh.
Yeah, I think that's a very pertinent comment, because you know these illusions are good when you have no other way of achieving control, right? Because they can calm you down. But once you're in a situation where you can make sense of things, if you're still holding on to these illusions, you know, very dangerous things can happen.
Matt, do you have one in particular?
Well, I think that I'd rather speak in general terms. Me to say, the 6 months after I got back, I set the bar for boneheaded behavior.
Okay. We'll let you off the hook. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks for
Bye.
Calling. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Virginia in Sacramento. Hi, Virginia.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Okay. I have, as I said to the lady that answered the phone, I have never felt so out of control in my life with this bailout and everything going on with Congress. We have emailed. We have called. I have a cafe here in Northern California, and a lot of my customers feel the same way. We feel whatever we're doing, they're just not listening to us. It's a very, very frustrating position to be in. We don't know what else we can do.
Do you find people making these connections that don't exist, or doing weird behavior?
Weird behavior. I don't know what's weird behavior. No, I don't think so. I mean, the people I talk with and deal with are pretty sensible people, but there's a sense of lack of control over your own life and what direction you want things to go in.
Yeah.
Just nobody's listening to you out there.
Yeah.
The people that are in a position to do something are not listening to us.
Dr. Whitson, I mean, there is some sort of parallel that we could look back on the situation we're in, like the stock market crash, is there not, and examine what happened then?
I mean, I think so, definitely. There's actually some very interesting research that shows that around the time of the Great Depression, people actually started buying more books on astrology.
Oh,
and you know, I think even now, you know, particularly actually, we've just been contacted by people talking about how some are suspicious about, you know, the government's timing of their takeover of Washington Mutual, and since it occurred very shortly after the $700 billion bailout was proposed, you know, some people are saying, well, it's a conspiracy. They're trying to get people to support the bailout by, you know, by scaring everyone.
Mm-hmm.
That's very true. Scared is exactly the word that a lot of people feel. It's fear-mongering that they're trying to do to us to get us to go along with what they're doing. And we're not hearing from the people, enough people, that really are in a position to judge what other options we have besides what they just passed.
All right, Virginia, have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you. And, of course, there were a lot of conspiracy theories after 9/11.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it was interesting. There were two diametrically opposed beliefs that cropped up. In one, people were immediately convinced that Iraq was involved. And in another, people saw the CIA as the behind-the-scenes cause of the fall of the towers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's even similar effects historically with the bombing of London in World War II. Even though later statistical analysis showed that the bombs fell randomly, people were still convinced that they had targeted particular areas of the city. And, you know, there were some really negative outcomes from this. People in the areas of the city that had been spared were suspected of being Nazi sympathizers. Their lives and livelihoods were often endangered because others wanted to retaliate against them.
Mm-hmm. Is it Desfandi? Is that who it is in Louisville? Hi there.
Paul.
Hi there.
I just want to offer a small comment.
Sure.
isn't it true that humanity at large is guilty of inferring that there is a causality when, in fact, there is only a correlation?
You mean whether they're out of control or not, they're looking for causality?
Well, you know, we all do this, you know.
Yeah.
We see a correlation and we think there is causality, and you got to do a very detailed design experiment before you can infer that there is, in fact, causality, you know.
Jennifer?
I mean, I think that's a very interesting question. We haven't looked at it from exactly that angle.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. You know, people who are under stress all the time, I'll point to one of my favorite topics, baseball. You know, you have these pitchers, you have baseball players to win, to become first, to win the World Series. They've got all kinds of superstitions.
They do, and it's actually fascinating because they've actually found that the players whose positions are most affected by luck and chance are those that have the greatest number of superstitions. So outfielders, not particularly superstitious, but when you're about to go up to bat, people often have lucky shirts. They have these, you know, complex rituals they go through. You know, they have to have a particular bat they pick.
Yeah, and they never, some of them never touch the foul line. They jump over that foul line.
Exactly, yeah.
And then they go out and blow the ball game. At least here in New York, they do. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Mark in Roseville, California. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I've been very excited in hearing the conversation here because it snaps something into focus for me. I work in a domestic violence prevention program for men. And what I notice is that most men describe when they did their violence, they were feeling out of control in their family and got this sort of magical thinking that if they did what they did, if they were more controlling and more macho and more dominant, that somehow that would bring their family closer together when that was, in fact, the behavior that was separating them from their family to begin with.
Hmm.
That's a really interesting comment, Mark. And I think, you know, of course, I haven't examined this particularly, but a lot of times you hear people interpreting the behavior of those that they abuse in a very particular way. You know, they took this small action, but it implies that it's because they don't respect me, or it implies because they're trying to do something behind my back. Yeah. And they essentially start getting these conspiratorial ideas about what's going on that aren't warranted.
Thanks, Mark.
Yeah. You're welcome. Thank you.
So as Mark says, can you then turn things around? If you can find a way to calm yourself, to calm your brain down, does that put you back in control?
I think it can. Our sixth study in our paper actually looks at whether self-affirmations would reduce illusory pattern perception, and they do. But, of course, by self-affirmation, I don't mean, you know, looking yourself in the mirror and saying, I can do anything. We actually gave people a list of six values and asked them to rank them. And then we gave people an opportunity to answer questions, essentially to discuss the value that they held dearest for a while. And those were the people whose illusory pattern perception dropped because, you know, values, you always have control of your values, no matter how chaotic the world is around you. And they had been given a chance to confirm the things that they held dearest in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that kind of returned their sense of control to them. And I think that sort of can be widely extrapolated, you know. Even if you're in a situation where you're particularly chaotic, taking a moment to step back and take stock and recognize that no matter how chaotic this situation is, it's not the entirety of your universe. There's still things you have control over. You know, even in the worst and darkest situations, you always have control over how you react to that situation. Mm-hmm. But in many cases, if your workplace is chaotic, you know, your home life might still be calm. You might still have control over that.
Mm-hmm.
Finding other areas and sort of just focusing on those for a moment.
Mm-hmm. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking about losing control with Jennifer Whitson, of the assistant professor at the McComb School of Business. That's part of the University of Texas at Austin. Let's go to the phones to Bob in St. Paul. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for taking my call. Hello, Dr. Whitman. I'm concerned about some of the extrapolations that you're making from your study. You know, I'm sure that you have found something. I thought that some of the examples you referred to earlier would be consistent with something that we might see in obsessive-compulsive disorder in terms of rituals and things that people need to do in order to feel safe. But I'm concerned that this would be extrapolated to people that believe in conspiracies, as it were, in terms of creating the notion that all people that believe in the existence of a conspiracy are somehow off, in the sense, for example, of the Kennedy assassination and the belief that the investigation following that was a whitewash.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd just like to hear your comments on my ideas there.
All right, Bob.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for calling. Maybe people are, maybe there is a conspiracy sometimes, he's saying. Even when you think there is one, you might be right, I guess, to sum him up.
And I think, yeah, I mean, exactly. You know, and I think just because people perceive illusory patterns doesn't mean that sometimes something's not, you know, actually mm-hmm. there. But it's something that definitely requires further examination.
Mm-hmm. Where do you go from here with this kind of research?
Well, I'm really interested in looking at what will help people to accurately perceive patterns. What would make people better able to more efficiently understand complex or chaotic situations and sort of, you know, come through them understanding exactly what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also interested in what kind of form the illusory patterns take. You know, are they particularly threatening because they're coming out of a threatening situation, or are they comforting because they're a response to the threat where we're trying to make ourselves feel safe again?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we're all familiar with having a big argument, a blow up in your family, and accusing people of all kinds of stuff. Would that be part of this kind of problem? And you're under huge stress, and then, you know, you accuse your spouse, your kids, or whatever. You know, you're all in this together against me.
Yeah, I think that's actually a great example of people sort of perceiving a conspiracy where one might not really be there.
Yeah.
You know, thinking that all of your family members are, you know, acting against you is probably not an accurate assessment most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, good luck to you, and thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thanks.
Jennifer Whitson is an assistant professor in the Department of Management at the McCombs School of Business, part of the University of Texas at Austin. That's about all the time we have for today. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarian Key Molesky. Comments or questions, go over to our website, leave us email there. We're podcasting and blogging, and you can download our Science Friday video pick of the week. It's a great pick of the week this week, as we have dozens of them up there, and also you can download them. You can load them onto your iPods. We can they're video iPods. You can podcast them just like you can our audio iPods. If you want to send us email, send it from there. Or the old-fashioned way, Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.